Verse 3. I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Now, you remember, we're in a patriarchal society, very patriarchal society, and we can argue the merits of that all we wish, but it doesn't change the fact that that's where we are. So if we're in the society and we want to show honor, then we have to operate in that regard. So Paul is saying Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ. Now, this will make some more sense to you if you try to understand what the word head means. When we're talking about this, we might say, I'm the head guy. I'm the boss, you know. I'm the one who tells you what I'm the head guy. But you remember that the relationship, you want to get a better angle, huh? Yeah. The relationship between Christ and his Father and the Holy Spirit was collegial. You know, Jesus said, you shall not lord it over one another like the Gentiles do. Their relationship was, I got a good look at it, I can see it now. Their relationship was such that one didn't boss the other one around. They didn't handle each other with authority. They respected each other to the point that there was no need for authority. You know, the Bible talks about the fact that we should be led by the eye of God. That we're so sensitive to what God wants that His mere suggestion at something is something that we're glad to do, as opposed to Him having to whipsaw us around with the bit and the bridle like a stubborn horse or a mule. So when we see the word head here, it's in our egalitarian Western world. It makes us. It provokes us a bit, especially if you're a woman and you're particularly sensitive to the male issues of our society around this. Now, you have to remember that you don't have to go very far in this world to where that isn't true. We're used to living here in the United States of America. And in the United States of America, we have more egalitarianism, more rights for women than anywhere else in the world. We look, for instance, at what goes on with the Muslims, and you know, we decry it, and we should, because their stuff is very often abusive. But even when it's not abusive, it's different. I mean, if you have I'll give you a better example. Okay, some of y'all know that I have a relationship with these people over in Kenya, with Charles Mulley. Charles Mulley is a great man of God. And he has these orphanages where, you know, he's raising 2,000 children every year. He and his wife, they put all his kids through college and did all this stuff. He has basically given up his millions of dollars in order to raise these children in the whole nine yards. It's a patriarchal world. And in his family, his older children don't get married until their 30s or later because he won't allow it. And if you were talking to him about various things, you'd say, well, this is just a wonderful man. But then if you get inside of his culture, you'd go, what do you mean he won't allow it? He decides when they can get married and to whom they can get married. And they don't think anything much of that. I mean, if you ask him, well, why aren't you married? He goes, well, you know, daddy hadn't really found me the right girl yet. You know, I mean, our reaction to that is that is an abusive use of power, but it's because of our culture, not because there's anything biblically abusive about it. Does that make any sense? Our response to that, you know, it probably wouldn't surprise you though to know that sometimes when people from other cultures take a look at us, they're shocked at much of our behaviors because they think of us as dishonoring, lacking respect for this or that, or out of control, way too liberal, all those sort of things. So, he says here, I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and the God is the head of Christ. He's using three comparatives. Christ is the head of a man, okay? We kind of get it that Jesus is the boss over men, and that men are the head of women. Oh, we don't like the idea that men are boss over women. But then it says, and then God is the head over Christ. Well, God is the boss over Christ? I mean, so do we really think that that's the, what that means in them? And it doesn't. What it mean, headship is also, you means covering. Covering, as in protection, as in, you know, Nancy and I, for instance, provide covering for our children. I provide covering for Nancy. When I pray for my family, I pray from a position of spiritual authority that's been both given to me and for which I'm made responsible. I am providing spiritual covering. And so it's not a matter of bossing people around. It just feels that way when we read it because of our language. Every man who has something on his head while praying and prophesying disgraces his head. Now, you see, he's quickly gone to covering as opposed to bossing. You see this? He's saying, if a man has anything on his head while prophesying, he disgraces his head. So when we first read that first sentence, it sounded like we were deciding who's boss over who. But if the second sentence immediately gets us into some place that's different than who's bossing over who, and it almost makes no sense. It like comes out of nowhere. The only way they make sense is to realize that they mean the same thing in both sentences. You with me? So every man who has something on his head while praying and prophesying disgraces his head. So what he's saying is a man should not have head cover on his head while he is praying. You all remember, I'm sure you do, that monks used to have a little place in the top of their scalp that was all shaved off. They had a tonsure. It's also called a solideo. Solideo means to God alone. The tradition behind that is that this particular part of their head was available to God alone because he's up there looking down. And so they cut this part of their head, this their hair, in order to not have covering between them and God. That's Catholic monks we're talking about. Friar Tuck, you know? Okay.
So, but this says not to have, a man doesn't have, shouldn't have covering on his head, means that he shouldn't have anything between him and...
It means if you're in a service, he shouldn't have a hat on. And
just really...
Yeah. Because it's a symbol of independence. I mean, he's blocking the connection between he and God. That's the cultural understanding. Now, what you're going to see here is that a lot of hair is considered covering, you know, whereas a normal amount of hair is not. But what I was talking about, the monks were that they used to shave their head, and some monks and some groups would shave the whole head. In order to not have covering. So that's the cultural understanding. So if a guy is covering his head, he disgraces his head, he said. Every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same with her whose head is shaved. Now, in the pagan world, the women who were the priestesses of the temples had a whole different stature or cultural position in the society. And it was very feminist. Without trying to cast aspersions on all feminism, feminism was used as a counterculture rebellion from the beginning of time. So, particularly in a patriarchic world, you could see that feminism is more than just some sort of a style where we agree on how we're going to relate to each other. It's actual full-on rebellion. Because the women are supposed to be submissive to the men, and feminists, by definition, are saying they're not. And what would happen with these priestesses is not only would they not obey men, they would try to dominate them. And one of the things that they would do is shave their heads. And so it was a symbol of, it was an in-your-face sort of, you know, anti-culture, anti-male, anti-the-society position they were taking. These female prophetesses would go into an environment where the men would be talking and they would bust out and scream and holler and say whatever they want to say, and they would disrupt the community, disrupt the society. They would disrupt the discussion that was going on. It was considered to be extraordinarily inappropriate. But they would try to dominate. In fact, one of the ways they would try to dominate men is sexually. This whole thing about sadomasochism and dominatrix and all that. All this goes back to this whole time frame here. So they were seen as sort of trying to, as anarchists, trying to overthrow the existing order, sort of in your face to the existing order. And so when they would, when people would do these things, they were seen of as not God-fearing, not godly. I tell you what it would be like. If someone... Huh? Yeah. Yeah, or just shut the door. It is shut? We can shut those two, Fred, and see if that'll work. Well, there is. If I have to, I'll go ask them to tone it down a little bit. All right. Let's see. Where was I? What, huh? I know. I had something I was fixing to say, and I forgot what it was. I know what it is. If we were sitting there Sunday morning in church, and somebody walked in, and she had on a mini, mini, mini skirt and a dress down to here, you would say that's inappropriate. Now, you might not even think that it would be inappropriate at some other time, but you would say that's definitely inappropriate. And if she was loud and brash, you'd say that's inappropriate. You would say this person has no couth. They have no culture. They have no training. They have no respect for what's going on. And if she were like 78 and overweight, you'd think it was really inappropriate. You'd think it was bizarre. Because we do have a sense of how we think people ought to dress and ought to act and ought to behave. If you had somebody, for instance, who got rowdy during a funeral, you would think, well, you know, that's just totally inappropriate. Paul is saying Christians in this society are in the minority. They are people who are lied about a whole lot. People say that, you know, one of the emperors wrote an article called About Crestus. It was kind of a little book. And his name is Marcus Aurelius, and it's actually later, but it was typical. And he said that Christianity is a barbarian religion. First of all, they have a paucity of gods. They only have one God, so they're not very religious people. Otherwise, they'd have a lot of gods. Secondly, they eat the body of their God. They're cannibalistic. And the third thing is that they have leadership made of women and slaves. And even children are heard among them. So the society around them agreed that Christians were a real no-class people. They were not... and as such, it put us in a position of of not being very good representatives of Christ to the community. So what Paul is saying to the people here at Corinth is I don't care how you think it's okay to act based on how you've always acted. You've got to realize that you have an obligation and responsibility to behave in a manner that brings credit to Christ. And we should be, I mean, you know how it is, we love it when our children show up and they're clean cut and they're mannerly and they say yes ma'am and no ma'am and whatever. They show respect and they help the old lady across the street. And when they do those kinds of things, we're proud of them. And when they just act like yahoos, then we just sort of shake our head and go, you know, hadn't learned anything yet. You know, so Paul is trying to get these people to shake off some of these pagan cultural practices and to become more appropriate in their behaviors in that. So he says here, if a woman covers her head while praying or prophesying, or has her head uncovered while praying or prophesied, she is the same as if she'd had it shaved. Now, I remember when I was a child that all women wore hats to church. And you did not go to church without a hat. Now, we don't do that anymore, and nobody thinks anything of it. But we did then. Now that nobody thinks anything of it, it's not a big deal. You can come in looking like Bella Abzug with a huge hat on right now, and people go, well, that's must be Easter. You know, I mean, because you don't see that. But if you purposely and intentionally flaunted came to church with no hat and just, you know, did that, or bobbed your hair, or whatever it is that was, you know, whatever, people took it as an insult, not to just themselves, but to the Lord and to the service. You know, if somebody, like I said, got drunk at a wake or at a funeral or whatever and acted out, or, you know, somebody came in and started yelling, he was a mean old man, and you know what, you know, I mean, you'd say, well, that's just wrong behavior. It's disrespect. Now, if you were the pastor of the First Methodist Church, then it would cast aspersions on you and your church and your God and everybody else. You'd have a hard time witnessing, you know, after that. So Paul gives the Corinthians a crash course in patriarchal culture and expectations. Jesus, he said, is the head over us all. He is our canopy, our shelter. He is we reside under him, and we do so voluntarily and gladly. We're submissive. We're not lorded over or dominated. We acknowledge him as our head, just as he acknowledges his Father as the head. And for that reason, women and children and servants in the family should acknowledge the headship of the master or the husband or the father. Children should honor the headship of their parents. Servants should honor the headship of their masters. Now remember, Paul is telling people, and so does Jesus actually, that they, if they are servants, they should continue to be servants. They shouldn't try to be set free. If they're slaves, if they've been bought and they're a slave, if they're indentured, they got a service, they shouldn't try to become free. Now, in our world today, we would say that any person who was a slave of another person has not only a right, but an obligation to run away from that person, to get out from under that. But frankly, there's a lot of places in the world today where servitude is a common deal, and it's very legal and legitimate. Y'all remember the indentured servitude that people went through to come over to this country. And there's a lot of places in this world that the way that people get basically started in life is by indenturing themselves to some family or another for some period of time until they get on their feet or learn or whatever the case may be. And we can say to those people, well, you shouldn't be that person's servant. You know, you should, whatever. So Jesus is our Lord and Savior, our canopy, our shelter. He exercises authority and he provides covering, which also means protection. Even Jewish male believers wearing yarmulkes dishonored Jesus. The Jews wore a cap over their head for the purposes of acknowledging that they were Jewish. But what Paul was telling them is, you're not under the law anymore. You're not under the law anymore. So, you know, you wouldn't be wearing this because you're not. Otherwise, you're sort of acknowledging you're Jewish. You're discrediting what Jesus has done for you. By showing dependence on the law versus Christ's sacrifice, that's what happens. That's why they're dishonoring the Lord with the yarmulke. Men provide covering or shelter for women. God provides covering for Jesus. If a man covers himself by wearing a hat or long hair, he dishonors God and denying his dependence on God. Extra long hair was typical of a male prostitute. And there were male prostitutes, if you remember. If a woman, in other words, they were effeminate. They were intentionally effeminate. If a woman acts independently of her husband, she likewise dishonors him publicly. Unmarried women are covered by their fathers. So if a woman is unmarried, she wouldn't be living in an apartment by herself. You know, she would be living at home under the covering of her father. And she would be honoring the father's household by being obedient to the father's rules and by serving in the father's household, etc., etc. This is especially bad, Paul is saying, in public worship. If we're in public worship and people are behaving in inappropriate ways, it casts aspersions on the Lord. She's acting like a shaved head prophetess. These mantic prophetesses would come into the services. Some of these people got saved, so to speak, but they got saved, but they didn't get enculturated. And they would come in, and having been used to being in worship services and being loud and brash and whatever, they would continue to be the same way. So, you know, Paul didn't say to women in his entire sphere, let a woman keep silent at church. He said it at certain places. where it was a problem because of the way they were speaking. Now, if you go back just one paragraph there, it says that a woman, it says, every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head. Well, obviously, he's expecting women to pray and prophesy. Obviously. So when he says, let a woman keep silent in church, what does he mean? Because if he's expecting to prophesy or pray, then, you know, what does he mean when he says, let them keep silent in church? You have to read it in context. It's in the context of these shaved head mantic prophetesses that he's talking about that.
When you said that Jewish Christians did not have to wear, now have to follow the law, I guess I thought you didn't have to be, if you were Gentile, you didn't have to go through
the front of the door
to Judaism, to Christianity, but if you were Jewish, you didn't have to quit doing. Are you saying you had to quit following law?
Depends on which laws you're talking about. You remember that God said,
talking about the yarmulke, and then how did they know which one's two and which one's not?
Well, I think that some of that was clear to them. For instance, when Peter was told by God he didn't have to worry about the food laws anymore, he's talking to a Jew, to Peter. So I think it got around. I mean, remember that at one particular point in time, Paul rebukes Peter because Peter was eating meals with Gentiles and eating their food until representatives from James came from Jerusalem, and then Peter quit. He withdrew, and he quit doing that because he didn't want to be seen as participating with these Gentiles. And Paul, as he says, rebuked him to his face for being double-minded. Okay, so they knew what they should do and what they shouldn't do. One of the things, for instance, that
do the Messianic Jews today wear yarmulkes?
I don't know if they do or not, but you know it wouldn't make any difference because we're talking culture. In our culture, they can wear a baseball cap, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll still see people who, you know, they'll walk into church and their kid's got a baseball cap on and they'll jerk the cap off his head. You still see people doing that. See, like that cap right there? Bad hair day, yeah. So...
Well, now, on this scene, you have unmarried women are covered by their fathers, and then it goes, this is especially bad in public worship. What's bad in public worship?
The being uncovered in public in the church. That's a parenthetical statement, that unmarried thing is parenthetical. So the this goes back to the pre-parenthetical remark. Isn't that the way you did it in sixth grade in literature?
Yeah.
Yeah, the this goes back to the pre-parenthetical remark. Okay. All right. It scandalizes the community and misrepresents the Lord. If you got some neighbors you're trying to win to the Lord, and you know you have you know that your relationship with God provides you with peace and there's order in your life and all this sort of thing, and you're trying to help them to see this. And someone you know who's a Christian comes along and they're acting just really wild. It's like you just sort of blanch because, you know, it's like they're making an impression upon your neighbor you wish they weren't making, because they're misrepresenting God as you're trying to share them with that neighbor. And, you know, they may have grace, to do what all they're doing, but it's not helping you to represent God right. So part of this is that, you know, we live in a culture that has just about given up on honor. We live in a culture where honoring other people is for old folks. Honor is not a common courtesy anymore, honoring people. And you have a hard time, for instance, having people know how to use honorable speech, especially with their enemies. I mean, one of the things we're talking about in our politics is that people are just screaming at each other at the top of their lungs and nobody's listening. Even in places where it has been traditionally, people have honored each other, like in the Senate or the Congress or in court, you're now seeing a breakdown of all of that. You remember a while back, about 6-8 months ago, some one of the congressmen shouted out that Obama was a liar when he said something, and he became a big hit with the Yahoos in this country because they liked that he would get up and do that. But he totally dishonored the culture of the House, and so he had to apologize. But then when he goes home with his friends, you know, and he's trying to get up votes, he's going, well, they made me apologize, but, you know, whatever, I'm going to stick it to him, you know. Well, you know, the lack of civility in our country pretty well assures that we'll never get anything done because there's no statesman left anymore. People don't know how to disagree agreeably.
One of the things I like about Huckabee is that he can interview people he doesn't like, doesn't agree with, and he's such a gentleman. He's just a great example of how to deal with people he don't agree with.
Yeah.
I haven't learned that yet. I've watched his program 2 or 3 times just to see if I could get some of that.
Well, I think part of it is, though, is that there's a whole group of people in this country that consider him a wimp. Because he's not, they want him up in their face and all that sort of thing. You know that there is a biblical prohibition against reviling. Reviling is one of the, in the list of things that you can go to hell for, adultery, murder, and reviling. They're all that same list. And yet we tend to think of it as a virtue. Anyway, if a woman does not cover her head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, then let her cover her head. In other words, if you're not going to cover your head, you might as well shave your head. But if you think shaving your head is a disgrace, then so is not covering it. A man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Now, this is so that she doesn't scandalize the angels. The angels, for instance, they live in the society of heaven, and they know how things ought to be. And when human beings who are supposed to be the sons of God, you know, the followers of Christ, behave in certain ways, you know, the angels go, what is wrong with these people? You know what the angels call us? They call us Adam, dirt beings. The word Adam means dirt beings. We're made of dirt. We're made of clay. And, you know, they'll go, you know, those dirt beings, they really don't get it sometimes, you know. They have to recognize it's not their place to judge us. But I'm sure they must go, when, you know, these people pray raw, you know, when they're going to get it right. Actual head covering was a symbol of humility and submissiveness. Even decent pagan culture disapproved of shaven head women. They expected a good moral woman to wear a bonnet, a hat, or cover. If a woman will not cover her head or honor her husband, she might as well go about shaven-headed, is what he's saying. Now, one thing I want to emphasize is that even pagans felt this way. Even pagans felt like that there was an appropriate behavior for women and children and servants and men before other men, depending on who those men were. You remember that even in this male society, what we have is we have men over men. The society of the first century and previous to that was a patronage society. There was the patrons, those people who owned everything, and those people who worked for them. And so, for instance, every Monday morning, all of your household, you know, the Bible sometimes says, he and all, like it says the Philippian jailer, he and all of his household were saved. It didn't mean just his wife and kids. It meant all of his servants and the other people who were part of his household. There's actually a good book that I read on this guy by the name Vane, V-E-Y-N-E, I think I've got it at home. And it talks about the culture of the first century. But I have to look it up. I used to quote it, but I haven't quoted it in a long time. It was one of my seminary books. But if you are in a Hispanic culture, they have the padrón. The padrón is the oldest or the older, mature men of the community, and all other men honor them and respect them. The sort of easier to see is the drug lord or the Kappa, the dawn. A really good picture of the first century world is in the movie The Godfather. You've got the Don, who's Marlon Brando, and you've got this baker, and he comes in and he goes, Godfather, he said, I need your protection, because there's this guy, and he's down here, and he's wanting me to pay him money for protection, and you are my padrone. You're my Don, is what he says. And because they're Italian, not Spanish, but you're my Don. And he said, I need your help with this man. And the Don says, it is taken care of. It is taken care of. Don't be concerned. He says, now someday I may ask a favor of you, he says. And he says, well, that I'd be glad to do that. Well, of course, one of his favors was to make the wedding cake for his daughter's wedding. You know, so you have this whole system of the padrone rules over everything, but he also passes out favors. When we were in San Antonio, Texas is a town that has a lot of tourism as its main industry. And you can walk on the downtown streets of San Antonio at 3 in the morning and be perfectly safe. Because tourism, I mean, people are up and they're out partying in fiesta and they're not drunken and they're, you know, they're having a good time and, you know, the music is going and whatever. And you can walk in downtown San Antonio, La Vieta, the Riverwalk, all that area, and be perfectly safe at 3 in the morning. Once while we were there, some of the South San Antonio gangs broke out into a fight in downtown San Antonio. They didn't need to bring in the police. The dons, the padrones pulled them out of there faster than your head can spin, and there was no more repeat of that. Because the town fathers, the padrones, they know that they cannot afford this Yahoo Barrio behavior spilling over into, you know, those people wind up dead. They wind up, you know, feet first planted under somebody's gardens. And because it's just a no-no. They rule. In the middle of our American government, our San Antonio police force and all that, the padrones rule. They rule. And people, if you remember, we talked before about the kinsman redeemer. Remember we talked about that? Well, this is kinsman redeemer in another light. If somebody lost their farm in a poker game, they'd go to their padrone, and they'd say, you know, I was cheated in poker game. Can you help me with this? Or I've lost this, and it's my family's inheritance. Can you help me get it back? You know, that sort of thing. And the padrone would help them. Based on certain conditions. It's tribal. It's exactly tribal. It's feudal. It's tribal. It's patriarchal. It's all those things. So Paul is living in this world. They're living in this world. And for people to behave, you know how people in Europe sometimes talk about the ugly American, because we come over there, we're used to having our way. We want what we want. We got a lot of money in our pocket. You know, everybody else can kiss my patootie, you know. And we act and behave in such a way that they say to us, you know, you're a brash, coarse culture. You know, you lack sophistication, you lack politeness, civility. You know, you're just you got too rich too soon and you don't know how to handle yourself. So it's all that kind of stuff. When it becomes an issue as to whether or not we properly represent God, it becomes a problem to us. And if there's an overall lesson in all of this while we're picking through the innards of this culture, it is that we are meant to represent God well at all times. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. Okay, I walk in tonight and some group has taken our classroom. Okay. And the natural response is to say, you know, what the hell are y'all doing in here? You know, we've had this class for 2 years, whatever. And I walked in and I looked at the guy and he said, y'all are over there. It's okay. We're over there. Thank you. We'll do that. So I got ready to go back out and the lady said, oh, you can pass through. I said, okay. So we come through. Now, the natural response is to want to slap him upside the head. The more godly response is to say, okay, we're not going to fight over a classroom, and we'll get with Susan Fan and they'll work it out sometime next week, and you know, whatever. If I were to do what is natural, it would not represent the Lord very well. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I know that Wayne Clark, he's a good teacher, but he's a jerk. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Actually, they may not know you and may
Yeah.
They get that impression first before they find out.
It's true. It's true. And or I've heard such good things about, but he's just a, you know, he know better than my 12-year-old, you know. So, all right. Okay. Actually, actual head covering was a symbol of humility and submissiveness. Even decent pagan culture disapproved of shaven-headed women. They expected a good moral woman to wear a bonnet, hat, or cover. If a woman will not cover her head or honor her husband, she might as well go about shaven-headed. That's what Paul said. Man was made as a helper and assistant. Woman was made as a helper and assistant for man. She ought to cover her head physically and spiritually. Failure to do so scandalizes even the angels, not to mention the decent pagan or Jewish society. Angels are known to be observers of mankind. In Luke 15, Jesus says, I tell you in the same way that there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents rather than 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. In the same way, I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. They're watching. They're watching. They're rooting us on. They're praying, hoping we'll do the right thing. You know, you have the issue of the one angel sitting over here saying, don't do that. And the other one saying, yeah, you know, the demon saying, do that, whatever.
Well, oh. I have an angel assigned to me 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
Just to buffer my balls.
Yeah, well, yeah, get you one that's a little softer angel then. The notion of a guardian angel is biblical. There's one of the scriptures, for instance, where Ezekiel's Apocrypha says that you've got to be careful about scandalizing children because their angel represents them to the Father. You know, their angel, that child's angel. It means the guardian angel or whatever. And the word guardian angel is used in the scripture in that regard. All right, so let me move on with this a little bit and then I'll summarize some of it. However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also man has his birth to the woman, and all things originate from God. Now here's what's happening. Paul has been giving them the culturally understood and true relational structure of a society. But he says, however, in the Lord, this thing is got a little different look to it, because the woman is not independent of man, but the man's not independent of woman either. Now, y'all know we've read many times in Ephesians 5:23 that a woman should be submissive to her husband. Anybody got a Bible? You have Bibles there? Those of you who have Bibles, you can turn to Ephesians 5:23. Ephesians 5:23. The Bible tells us that women should be submissive to their husbands. And you got it there in front of you? Okay. So read me 5:23.
For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church.
Read me 5:22, I'm sorry.
Wives, be subject to your own husbands, as to the Lord.
Yes. Now the word be subject in there, is that in parentheses or is that in italics? It's in italics. And the reason it's in italics is because it's not in the text. Whenever you see an italicized word in a proper translation, that they're telling you is it's not in the text. If you look it up in the Greek, it won't say wives be subject to your husbands.
Okay, so it's going to say wives to your own husbands.
That's right.
As the Lord.
That's right.
The
Lord. Now, the reason it doesn't say that is because it takes its verb from 5:21. So even though they're separated, usually in a paragraph form, they're actually not separated. They're not part of the, there's a concept we call pericope, which is where does a biblical thought actually begin and where does it end? And it doesn't always end. And like if you notice some of my chapters, they don't end at the end of the natural chapter. They end 3 or 4 verses later. And some of them start 3 or 4 verses into the, you know, that's because of the pericope. So read 5:21. Pericope, P-E-R-I-C-O-P-E. Pericope, like periscope without the S. Pericope, pericope.
Okay, so you want 21?
Yeah, read 5:21.
Well, why don't we just go back and read 18?
Well, let's don't do that first, because 21 is the head of the sentence.
21 says, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ.
Okay, that word be subject there, that's not in italics.
No.
That's because that's where the verb comes from.
Okay.
Okay, so he's saying be subject to one another. He's saying you all should all be subject to each other. And then he says, wives to husbands. Okay? Now you can go back to 18 or 19.
And do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks for all things in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God, even the Father. And be subject to one another in the fear of Christ.
That's right. So what's happening is the whole notion of being subject falls inside of a larger teaching which talks about how we should honor one another, get along with one another, treat each other with respect, treat each other with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. In other words, handle each other in a godly manner. Because to do so is to honor God. That's what he's saying. Okay. So, Nancy and I have been married for 42 years. And I will tell you that my wife is a very submissive wife. And she honors me in so many things, and she serves me in so many ways. But that's not where it stops, because I honor her and I serve her as well. The particular thing that Paul says to me is, husbands, live considerately with your wives, because your prayers will be hindered if you don't. If you don't handle your wife properly, God won't hear your prayers. That's what he's saying. When you read on down there later on. But the reason why Paul says that is because the men have the power. And so he's saying, look, you've got the power, but you need to live considerately with your wife. You need to consider your wife. And he goes on to say, because she's the weaker vessel. He doesn't mean that she's the weaker vessel in terms that she's not strong as you are, or that she can't bear up as much as you can. I mean, you know, first guy who tries to have a baby will figure that out. Or tries to keep one all night for, you know, 20 years will figure that out. But the point is he's saying she is the person with less authority. She has less power in the culture. So therefore, she requires your covering. She requires your protection. It's up to you to put a fence around her because she is submissive and because she doesn't have the authority. Now, if somebody... if I found somebody messing with my wife in terms of threatening her or whatever, I'd hurt them. Because it's my job to make sure that she's protected from things. My job is to cover. But as I've told you this before, in about 2001, as I was praying to the Lord about various aspects of my own life, because as I walk with the Lord, he keeps showing me new stuff he wants me to fix. And in about 2001, it was time for this lesson. And the Lord said to me one day, when I was praying about him, praying to him about what he wanted me to work on in my life, he said to me, he brought Nancy to my attention, and he said to me, Wayne, the number one person you need to protect Nancy from is you. Me. The number one person a man needs to protect his wife from is himself. Because he is the person most likely to take advantage of her. Now, I don't mean that in a bad way, like slap her around or anything. It's just that a submissive wife is easy to abuse. And I don't. When I say abuse, that sounds like, we use the word abuse to mean bang, 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 or whatever. Take advantage of. It's easy to not care as much for. It's hard to even say it. It's easy to let your submissive wife, you know, go do all the work and bring you the tea. I mean, a man can get off of his butt and go get the tea for himself. She doesn't have to bring it all the time. Now, very often, she's quite willing to do so, glad to do so. There's a whole sense in which many women feel quite fulfilled in serving their family. And if they have no family fulfilled, it gets bad. Talk about empty nesting. You talk about widowhood, whatever. I mean, there's a whole sense of what do I do? You know, so they go volunteer. They go to wipe somebody else's kids' noses, and they go care for somebody else's and whatever. Because there is a servanthood very often in women that's not just culturally derived, but it's spiritually derived. And for them not to have the opportunity is a problem. But that doesn't mean that we men should take advantage of it. What it means is we should appreciate it, be grateful for it, but make sure they have time too. Make sure they have done. Make sure that when we get ready to do something, that their needs and desires are taken into consideration. You know, if we keep going on vacation to some place where we're fishing and golfing, you know, and there's never anything in there that's a, you know, blessing, you know. I mean, like we went to Europe on a 12-day cruise. Didn't get to fish or golf once in that process. Y'all see what I'm saying? There's a responsibility for he who has the cover and the protection to live considerately with their wife. So this stuff that he's speaking to here, it flows out of this understanding that we've been talking about a mutual submissive nature and behavior. Now, I'll tell you what happens a lot, and I think you'll agree this is what should happen. We might be out somewhere, and I might say something, and Nancy might realize that I've misspoken some way or the other. And maybe it's not all that consequential, but I have. We used to have these friends of ours who would just drive you crazy, because everything he would say, she would correct. And so, you know, he'd be going, okay, well, we took a vacation, you know, last August. She said it was September. Okay, it was September. And then we, you know, we went to you know, Florida. Well, actually, we only went to Macon. Okay, so, and so we were driving down I-75. Well, actually, we took 285 first. And, you know, and it was a constant correction of everything he had to say. And it was maddening to listen to, but she just had to correct him in everything he had to say. And it was just a way for her to kind of dominate him. There's a way. If I'm out somewhere and we're telling a story and I'm telling the story and we're driving home and she goes, by the way, when you told that story, you know, you got this little thing here backwards and all that kind of stuff, I'd go, oh yeah, that's really right. Well, that's one way to handle it. The other is to stop me in the middle of what I'm doing and saying, well, you got that wrong. Now, there's even a right way to do that if in the way you're doing it, you're not. We all know when that's good, and we all know when it's bad. We all know. It'd be like me stopping Steve in the middle of a sermon and saying, well, you know, you got that wrong about the Philippians. They actually were, you know, in southern Galatia. I mean, I hear people get up and share, you know, in church, and they'll sometimes get a detail wrong. And it doesn't matter, you know. So if I were to get up and stop them and say, by the way, you got that detail wrong, what does that do? It interrupts the flow of the Spirit. It's not honoring to God. It's not helpful. So one thing Paul's saying is we should live and act around one another in ways that are peaceable and loving and helpful and whatever. And sometimes being right is not near as important as being rightly related. You know, if I said to you all, okay, we're having a party at our house next Saturday, Nancy'd say, well, actually, honey, it's Friday. That's important, you know, because if you guys all show up on Saturday, you know, we're going to be sitting here going, we have, you know, a tub full of rotten dip that, you know, nobody ate last night, and here you are showing up, we don't have anything for you. There are things that's important, that's important about, but some of the others not. Now, when Paul is talking about this cultural stuff in the world, he's saying, this is our world's culture. This is what they expect. And when we behave differently than this, regardless of what we think about whether something's right or wrong, we are causing the world to think of us badly, and more importantly, we're causing them to think of God badly. And so what he's saying is that it's not just a matter of being right and wrong all the time. Sometimes it's a matter of being rightly related or doing things in a correct and good manner, even if the details aren't together right. So he says that, and Jesus said, but Jesus said this, he said, in the world, he said, they lord it over one another, but it will not be so among you. He said, among you, the greatest of you will be the servant of all. You know, and he gives us this whole process, turn the org chart upside down. Well, Paul's doing some of the same thing here in verse 11. However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of a woman. For as the woman originates from man, so also man has birth through women, and all things originate from God. So we can sit around and argue about who came first, you know, the chicken or the egg, and who came first, you know, the woman or the man. But we all came from God. And so, you know, there's a sense in which it hardly matters. In the teachings of Christ, there is a new way of looking at gender issues. Jesus demonstrated that God values both genders equally. He relates to both men and women the same and was criticized for it. Jesus sees it more like a circle than a linear structure. Men and women are mutually dependent and mutually to be honored. Ultimately, all are dependent on and created by God. Jesus did not grasp for equality with the Father. He became a bondservant to the Father. In Philippians 2:5, we are told to have this. Have this attitude in yourselves. Have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself out, taking on the form of a bondservant, being made in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by being obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross, which is the most ignominious way for a person to die. So we shouldn't wrestle for equality or preeminence. He taught us to serve one another, not lord it over each other. What we really need in all of this submission stuff and all that we're talking about here is we need people who are kind of in a contest to honor each other. We need people to be as civil as they can possibly, even when they disagree. We're not asking everybody to agree with what's wrong. We're just asking people to disagree agreeably. We need people who are preferring one another in love. It ought to be like, let's have fish. No, let's have chicken. Yeah, that's fine. In other words, we ought to be making sure that the other person is preferred over ourselves. If we're acting and behaving that way, we're going to bring honor to God. And we're going to stick out like a sore thumb because nobody else is. We're going to be seen as representing the Lord right. What, huh?
I was thinking, we had a discussion yesterday with Valerie Beal. We were sitting behind her in church, and she just recently went on a mission trip with some people, and she was talking to people who had come out of the Muslim culture, right? And she was asking them how they view their God versus, you know, the Christian God. And she was saying that, you know, because you talked about this sentence about how God doesn't lord it over us, you know, he taught us to serve one another and not lord it over us. And she said the main difference, they were talking about how the God that they served in culture or whatever, you know, it was a lording it over type thing. And they said the main difference is the Christian God, he's for us. You know, he does want us to follow his rules so we have life. He's in our court. He's for us. You know, God comes and ministers to us.
The pagan gods were to be appeased. You had to appease them to try to get them to leave you alone, or you had to appease them to try to get them to do what you wanted them to do. And what Paul and Jesus are both telling us is our God is not trying to appease us. You know, in the pagan world, we die for the gods. In the Christian world, our God dies for us. Our God is the boss. He is the creator. He is due respect. But he doesn't put us in a position of having to appease him. Jesus called them to himself. He said, you know that the ruler of the Gentiles lorded over them, and their great men exercised authority over them. It is not so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Paul calls himself a bondservant, a slave of Christ. And he foregoes his apostolic rights in order to serve. In 1 Corinthians 9, if others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. He's talking about the fact that these super apostles were coming in and demanding that these people obey them because of their superior relationship with God or with the apostles in Rome or in Jerusalem, whatever. And Paul is saying, look, I fathered you in the Lord. And if anybody had a right to require you to obedience, it would be me. But he said, I don't use my rights as the father of you, over you. I put up with stuff and so as to cause no hindrance to the gospel. Judge for yourself. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with the head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach us that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? If a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her. For her hair is given to her for a covering. But if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, and nor have the churches of God. So Paul is asking for them to reason in accord with nature and the culture of his day. Should a woman come to church with an uncovered head? God forbid. Like I said, it was just the 50s when we had that as a going rule. Should she prophesy and speak out if she's uncovered? If a man wears his hair uncut, is it not humiliating to him? Now, we have a lot of pictures of Jesus with really long hair, and Jesus, I'm sure, had longer hair than the average Marine. The only people in Israel, only men in Israel who didn't cut their hair were Nazarites. You remember that the Nazarites, like John the Baptist, were people who specifically left their hair uncut. And if you saw somebody with long hair, you assumed they were either a Nazarite or a male prostitute. That's what you would have thought, because that's what it meant in those days. So even though we think of Jesus as having long hair like a hippie, you know, the hippies always used to say, well, all the pictures of Jesus look like this. His hair was...
thing for the length of his hair, or did we just assume he was somewhere near the norm or something of, you know, the customary?
If you hadn't been, that have said it about him. They were picking on him for everything else. His hair was not a problem, or they would have said something about it. But, you know, you have to think about this. You got the average working guy. Even if you've ever had long hair as a man or whatever, you know that it makes it really tough. Like you see these football players, for instance, with all this long hair, and they're doing shampoo commercials, you know, because, I mean, they have to, you know, then you have these people who whack their hair off and go, man, is that ever liberating, you know. If a man wears his hair uncut, is it not humiliating to him? Only Nazarites and Haraduli wore their hair uncut. Haraduli are the male, are the temple prostitutes. Is not long uncut hair a glory to a woman? Is not bobbed hair or shaven head a disgrace? If anyone is intentionally contentious, in other words, if they're doing this out of a sense of rebellion, why would someone shave their head? Why would a woman shave her head? I mean, given that there's no style for it. Well, in those days?
Why?
Well, if they did, but they wear a wig over it. I mean, what you said about lice is true, that many people in, not the ancient world, because the ancient people bathed more than the people in the nearer ancient world, but like in England and America during the 1600s and 1700s, many of those people did have short hair, but then they wore wigs on top, because to do otherwise would be to be inappropriate, you know. So, and no, the women did not have a style of shaving their heads in the ancient world. Only the Haraduli shaved their heads.
So, just look at a Nazarite or the male prostitute, or what else would be different about them in appearance only?
Between the two of them or between them and society? The Haraduli would be a lot sexier looking. John the Baptist came out of the desert and his hair was all matted, and he probably have grasshoppers and honey sticking out of his beard and all that kind of stuff. The Haraduli would probably have no beard. He would probably be very clean shaven, very long hair, and look like Yanni, you know. You know, they would be very sensual. That might be the word you would use, yeah. They would be perfumed and clean looking and whatever. Nazarites wouldn't particularly, you know. A lot of people were glad to go down in the water with John the Baptist because it was just good for everybody.
Please, please.
You have to think about this. Do you realize how cultural cleanliness is? You think about this. Do you realize it wasn't that long ago that people bathed infrequently and yet were intimate? You just have to think about that a little bit, you know. Would they put cotton up their nose? As far as that goes, you can go to... have you ever ridden in a plane to Kenya? I have ridden... When I go to Kenya, I take a book. I haven't got a little book. I take a book and I do this. Because smelling the binding keeps me from smelling everything else. The planes in inner Africa, not the ones between here and Africa, although if you're on a plane from here in Africa, somebody will go down the aisle and a whiff will just, you know, it'll look like wheat field. The whole aisle will go back like this, you know.
The wave,
that's right. Because there are cultures of people for whom smelling what we would call awful is normative. You know, and you know, bathing is not a big deal, and there's that manly smell. So
part of it's diet too. So
well, they don't eat much.
Especially with Eastern Indians.
Well, you're talking about people have curry type smells or whatever, but
garlic.
Well, that, you know, that sort of thing. But when we brought a British bed into the country. In our business, it's a medical bed. It was an air bed. We brought it into the country and introduced it to America because it was a really good bed for people with bed sores and stuff like that. And there's a number of them now, but we brought the first ones into the country, the group I was part of. And when we brought it in, we asked them for what their cleaning procedures were because in our hospital systems, we have very tight cleaning controls, you know. And they went, well, I don't know, wash it down once in a while. And we said to them, we cannot sell a bed here, you know, but people are going without proper cleaning procedures. And they said, you Yanks have a fetish for cleanliness.
They did a survey about how often British housewives wash their sheets during the year, they wash their sheets two or three times.
Oh, God. It'll crispy after a while.
Well,
where did you hear that?
Some survey she read, but I'm sure that's right. My point is that our cleanliness is cultural as much as anything.
So, when did the phrase cleanliness is next to godliness? When did that come into the culture?
It would be in our culture, not theirs, and it's not in the Bible.
Right.
It would be some mother trying to explain to her children why they should wash behind their ears.
Yeah.
You know, because frankly, a lot of godly people would have grossed you out.
Our dogs are cleaner.
Well, yeah, and they also eat better and have better health care and psychological care. And mm-hmm. All right. So if it not if, is not bobbed hair or shaven head a disgrace, if anyone's intentionally contentious, as evidenced by being improperly covered, we have no choice but to publicly resist them. This would happen in all churches, so it definitely should happen in Corinth. The problem was is Corinth was like the Wild Wild West. Most of your churches that you would go into in the empire wouldn't run into these kind of things. You would have to live in a place where you had oracles, temple prostitutes, and whatever functioning at a very high level before this would happen. Most of the places you would go into, like Philippi or something, they'd have temple prostitutes, but they wouldn't. They wouldn't come in polite society. They were where they were. In Corinth, it was like being in Vegas. It's like people were acting in the church what we talked about at the beginning of this, that there was a phrase called to be Corinthianized, which means totally lacking in any kind of moral fiber whatsoever. People went to Corinth to take a holiday from morality. They went to Corinth to, you know, whatever happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. They went to Corinth to let their hair down because Corinth was a place where it was really in to be bad. And so Paul is, you know, and remember, Paul took 18 months to build his church in Corinth. He took an average of 6 weeks in most places where he went. So it took him 18 months to get Corinth in enough shape to before he could leave it. And then as soon as he did, it got into trouble. But he had to write to it 3 times. He had to send Timothy once. Timothy wasn't strong enough, so he had to send Titus once. And then he had to go himself. Okay, so we've gotten through this cultural patch here. I'd like to invite questions, particularly any questions that relate to feelings about women being badly treated by men or dominated, or what the Bible, biblical position, feminism, anything along those lines.
And I thought you said that the woman has less power, because the woman has less power in the culture, that the male should cover her. And that's kind of what that meant.
Yes, ma'am. It means
it's... it's like a...
That's what he said.
But from a cultural perspective, yes.
That's right. You know, it's actually the same with children. Because children have less authority in the culture, we go out of our way to protect them. But when you're in your home, there should really be an interchange with the children that's much more collegial. Go back to the Trinity. You have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. If you ask yourself, who's the boss? You'll generally come up with the idea that somehow or another the Father has a preeminence. But you also see that they are mutually submissive and mutually honoring. You see what I'm saying? Well, it's harder for us. If you grow up in a feudal world, a patriarchal world, or a world, even a world like in the Padron system, where some men in the city are over other men in the city, there's a definite hierarchical structure, then some people are quite comfortable understanding that, you know, this person outranks me. Okay, I mean, I'm quite comfortable understanding that my boss outranks me. You know what I'm saying? I don't consider it to be, I don't consider myself as having been abused by having to submit to my boss. I don't feel demeaned by it. You see what I'm saying? Because I've accepted the fact that this man has some sort of a hierarchical right to tell me what to do. Now, if we were out somewhere fishing, and I didn't know him from Adam's house cat, or we were in the golf course, and he was saying, go get my ball over there, you know, do this for me, run, do this, would you run up here and get me a sandwich? I'd be going, you know, you got legs, buddy, what's your problem? You see what I'm saying? But inside of the understanding that there is a hierarchical structure, that it's for the good of everybody, that the army can't function any other way. I mean, like, for you talk about soldiers, okay? We praise our soldiers because of their absolute obedience to the order, charge, right? We take people into the army. We totally break down all of their sense of self-rights and try to reform them as a group as a community that flows together and obeys immediately. Okay? Now, under any other circumstances, that would be considered demeaning and abusive. If I were to build a little church community and all of my people were to act that way, you know, yes, sir, Pastor Wayne, and whatever, everybody who looked around would call it a what? A cult. Okay? But in the army, we don't call it a cult. I mean, the army is as good a definition of a cult as anything. You know? I mean, there's somebody who can tell you to charge that machine gun nest and die.
But at the same time, they take care of each other.
Well, yes, they do.
They take dead bodies off the field and...
Yeah. There's an honor among them.
Take care of them.
Yes.
So it's a two-way thing there. They're totally obedient, but then they are also totally responsible for their neighbor.
Yeah. If you're my general and you tell me to charge that machine gun nest and die, I'm just dead. You know, so the point is that somewhere along the line we have determined in our world, that sort of obedience is appropriate. in that sort of male. Whereas in other settings, it would be considered to be abuse. It's at a very high level. Yes, ma'am.
So, in one sentence, what are we to take from Paul's Corinthians in this, what we just studied?
This section?
Christians.
Okay.
Followers of Christ.
Followers of Christ. We should recognize that God is sovereign, that He has laid down His life for us, that he has submitted Himself for us and for our benefit, and that there is this collegial structure between God and the Trinity and all this sort of thing, mutual submission, but order. And that, you know, the Jesus didn't say, well, let the Holy Spirit go. Why should I have to go? There's a willingness to serve one another. Okay? And that being the case, we should mimic that. That our attitude should be like that as well. We should be, everybody understands that if we're sitting here doing a task or there's a dinner or there's a, you know, an accident and we're trying to, that you love it when someone says, what can I do? Tell me what to do. And if someone says, would you go do that? You go, absolutely, I'd be glad to go do that. And you know that when that happens, things are right. But if we're in the middle of something of this nature, and you say to someone, would you please go do that? And you go, who the hell do you think I am? You know, you go do it. Okay. Well, here, you finish the surgery, then, and I'll go get, the, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you're saying there is a hierarchy.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is, and it's in God, and it's mutual. I'll tell you one thing, one way to look at this, which is, I think, helpful, and that is that the hierarchy switches around. There are times when I need to be in leadership, and there's times when she needs to be in leadership, and frankly, there's times when the children need to be in leadership. You know, I mean, like, for instance, let's say that we're taking one of our children to his friend Johnny's house for a party. And he knows how to, and he knows the way. Okay? So I'm sitting here going, you know, well, I think it's this way or whatever. And he goes, no, Daddy, it's down this road here. And you're going, look, I'm the father. Don't tell me, you know, whatever. I mean, I should be listening to what Johnny says. He knows how to get there. Not insisting that I know the father. You know, this whole thing about, you know, I don't need a map and don't tell me what, you know, and all that sort of thing. Because I'm male, I have no need of anybody to give me directions.
But do you think that biologically the male is the hunter, the male is the provider, the male does have, for the most part, a greater ego, which makes him what he is, and the woman is by nature, most of the time, more of a servant, has more of a servant's heart.
I think we were designed to operate that way as a structure. But I think that to use that structure to lord it over one another, right, is an abuse of the structure.
Right.
So I think in almost every society throughout the world, the man has been the breadwinner, the fighter, the defender, or whatever. And the woman has been in a support role in many, many ways. But once again, if we're talking about trying to, if we need a leader in doing those things that the woman does best, the man needs to be able to take his hat off and jump in there and pitch in and help. And not have some sort of a... See, one of the things that I have a problem with some of the Southern Baptists, and I grew up in some of the Jimmy Carter Baptists, and the Southern Baptist ways of thinking, it's like men are biologically designed to be in leadership, and women are biologically designed to not be in leadership, and therefore women can never teach or preach or share or lead or teach the Bible, except to other women, that there's some sort of a hard rule about this. And I think they're wrong about that. I think you got all kinds of people in the Bible who would be examples where that isn't so. And I do know that down through the years in the translation process, that some of that's come into play. Like, for instance, in the original autographs, you get Aquila, or Priscilla ahead of Aquila in the list. But there are translations that put Priscilla second to Aquila in the list. And that's because in the ancient world, the person who's mentioned first is the leader. So like on the first missionary journey, it was Barnabas and Paul. And after that, it was Paul and Barnabas. I mean, halfway through, it became Paul and Barnabas, and then Paul and Silas. So the first in the list is the leader. You know, that's the way it is in that world. By the same token, you've got a gal whose name is Junia, and Junia is a female name, and she's listed as an apostle. And if you go to some of the translations, they translate it to Junius. They flip it to male because their bias is that women can't be in leadership. You get a picture, for instance, of Dorcas, who Peter goes to raise from the dead, as the house church leader. And yet what happens is we want to talk about how she made, you know, she knitted good. You know, when we talk about her leadership and her guidance, the way that you usually hear that presented is she made nice clothing for people. You see, you have Lydia, the seller in purple. This is a businesswoman. The sellers in purple were rich people. I mean, if you sold the purple dyes that the rich people wanted, it's like you're higher in stores, okay? And Lydia is the, you know, there's no Mr. Lydia. Lydia is a businesswoman. The church met in Lydia's home. It didn't meet in, you know, Theophilus's home with Lydia as the wife. You see what I'm saying? And so the biases that we've brought to the translations, some of the apologies, you got to remember, same logic was used in the South to present the idea that slavery was a God-designed organization, that it was good for the slaves, and that the Lord was pleased with it. That's the same kind of biases that were brought to that. Hitler used the same biases, and he quoted Paul and Luther in particular to say that wiping out Jews was the right thing to do. So, I think we're all made with purposes and gifts and skills, but all of us at the same time should be in a contest to be submissive and supportive, and we should not lord it over one another. I think a football team that where the quarterback's not calling the plays is not going to be very successful.
Right. From your experience in Africa, are any of the societies matriarchal?
I have not seen one. You know, the famous matriarchal society in Africa is the Amazons. And that is the Amazon women, who were known for being that, is a group, and when you do the research on it, is a group that was so small in one little area, and we've blown it up like they were all, you know, like muscled up and buffed up and whatever. But I've not. Of course, I've not been all over Africa. But I would bet a lot of money that you're not going to find any African societies that are female dominated.
Well, we have one in the U.S. I remember when taking my cultural anthropology, the Iroquois Indians live in longhouses near a matriarchal society, and the teacher sort of was kidding when he said that they were known as very vicious fighters, and he said they were probably so henpecked back in the longhouses that they took it out on their enemies.
Well, one of the things that you would have a problem with, it's not at all uncommon to find cultures in which women dominate. I mean, but it doesn't mean they should. It doesn't mean they were designed that way. But you find a lot of cultures in which women dominate, subcultures within our cultures. But one of the things that you would have is if the women were to actually have to do the heavy lifting and the heavy fighting, they would not be structured physically for that. They would actually have to become so roided up that after a while they would sort of, you know, you see women sometimes that you really have to wonder, are they still women? And you see men sometimes that you really have to wonder, are they still men? Because they've become so unmale, you know, in their structure. And then you get the people claiming gender confusion, you know. Other comments? I've got to quit, but yes, ma'am.
I want to do this really quickly because it's real deep and we may want to wait till next week. But I was talking to my foster daughter, who happens to be 26 now, and I asked her if the guy that I said, you know, the biggest mistakes I've made in my life is when I've been the farthest from God, Kim. And I said, when you were living with so-and-so, were you close to God? And she said, no. I said, do you think that you had a, you think he was a Christian? And she said, oh, sure, Mom, he believed in God. What I learned from that conversation really disturbed me, because I've missed the ball here, and it's because she's very teachable. Nothing was mentioned about Jesus. And what I realized is in our culture today, I can't say what percentage, but a great many people call themselves Christians that don't even know why they call themselves Christians.
They're churchgoers. They're religious people.
Yes, and this is what she told me.
Or they define it as belief.
Sunday, yeah. And so on and so forth. And the question to me was, Sharon, you've missed, you should have at least taught her whether she embraces it as her choice. And I went into choice and so on. But listening to Ireland declaring bankruptcy tonight, overnight we could have a whole collapse of our world economic system. And I guess my question to myself and to all of you is, where's the urgency? We are now at a point in our world where people really should be deciding or choosing where they're going to spend eternity. And I, as a Christian, do not have a sense of urgency about telling everybody I know. And I've really fallen short.
I think you should tell everybody the Lord tells you to tell. Yeah, I mean, I agree that you should tell everybody the Lord tells you to tell. St. Francis said we should at all times witness, and when necessary, use words.
That's kind of confusing, though.
I think what happens is that I think what's important, I think we would be a lot better off asking God to make us better Christians. You know, Jesus didn't tell everybody he met about God. He only told the people who came to hear him. You know, Jesus.
Not that many people come to hear him
anyway. Well, not that many people came to hear him. Not that many people came to hear him. Jesus said, the poor you have always with you. So, look, hon, the Lord's telling you to become evangelistic, I'm not the last person who want to tell you not to. But don't think that you have some sort of responsibility to go out.
But I'm to love my Lord, my God, with all my heart.
You are. You are. Yes.
And my neighbor is myself.
That's right. But teaching them about Jesus is not necessarily the way you show them love. You'll teach them about Jesus if you love them. Evangelizing them is not, you know, it's what I call the toothpick approach to evangelism, where you're constantly in people's face to confront them about knowing Christ. I think if you love people, you will teach them about Jesus. If they ask you, you should tell them. If you get an opportunity that doesn't drive them away, you know, to bring it up, you can do so. As soon as they say stop, you need to stop. You know why? Because the Holy Spirit does. I mean, if we take our cue from God, you know, God doesn't force himself on us. The Holy Spirit doesn't force himself on us. The Lord reveals himself to those who seek him. When Ben got into a whole lot of trouble, one of the things that we realized is that if we burned the bridge between him and us, that when he wanted to come back over it, there wouldn't be a bridge to come over on. And so our relationship with him never got to the place where we burned the bridge. And when he did want to come back over, it was still there. Some people get so active in trying to make people do what they think that they burn the bridge. And if the person comes to the Lord in spite of them, you know, not before it. But I'm not here to tell you what the Lord's telling you to do.
Well, I think you just told me.
Okay.
And that's to pray and wait on the Lord.
Well, and to ask God to make us better people, you know.
A world crisis is coming on.
Did you send the letter out to this class that I wrote?
Yes.
Y'all got it? Okay. I think that what's happening right now is got God all over it. And I think that God is going to meet us, but he may not meet us the way that we had hoped he would. What he may do is something that's much better for us than what he hoped we would. You know, it's kind of like saying, you know, God, the party's over. Can you restart the party? You know, well, you know, maybe that isn't how God's going to meet us. So, ultimately, I think what we just need to realize is it's the nature of Christ to be loving and kind and to prefer one another. There were times when he was very, very strong, usually to protect other people or to protect God's honor. There are other times when he just laid himself down like a lamb led to slaughter. Jesus has we all have a gear, and Jesus had a gear that could kick your tail, but he didn't use it near as often as we think he should. Because we're all kind of saying, I wish Jesus would stomp those Democrats, you know. I wish Jesus would stomp those gay people. I wish Jesus would stomp those, you know, liberal Presbyterians, you know. And he's not really in the stomping business.
But Hosea said, I fear my people will perish because of lack of power.
And they did. God said to Hosea, in Hosea 9, Ephraim is enjoying his rebellion, let him alone. Let him alone. God gets to a place with people where he goes, you know, don't try to teach the pig to sing. It won't work, and it irritates the pig. Y'all came here tonight voluntarily, and when other people are seeking God, they'll find such places also. What we need to see in our society is a whole lot more people seeking God as opposed to a whole lot more people telling people about God. I mean, we got way too much telling going on in our society.
I heard a tape one time, and the author was, he worked for Robbie.
Zacharias, yeah.
What's his name, the Scottish guy. And he said, you know, we try to give people all the answers, okay, as Christians. But the real thing we should be doing is stating the question, and the question is, where will you spend eternity?
It's a good approach. It's a good approach. And if they say to you, none of your damn business, then you're done. You know? Then you move on. I think that if we relate to people with kindness, when they're ready to cross the bridge, they'll come over it. You see what I'm saying? And if we live in such a way that they think we might have a light on, you know, inside, then when they get in the darkness, they'll come our way. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah, because we're supposed to be ready to share about the hope that's in us. And they're not going to ask if they don't see hope in us. You know, so I think if we're transformed, that light's going to shine to other people, and they're going to want to know, like, how can you have peace when this is going on or that's going on? I think people are, you know, will want to know. I think they'll ask you.
And I think probably more and more so as the world gets more chaotic.
Yeah, I think the chaos is actually going to bring the revival, at least in the hearts of many people. You got to remember that part of the end time structure is the cleansing of the church. I know you got to go. It's cool.
I got somebody waiting for me a trivia this
time. Yeah, yeah, that's okay. Charles Simpson. Charles used to say, "If you get done before I do, feel free to leave."
She must be
right. That's right. I got it. I think with
in Ireland, the artists don't have to pay taxes. Bonu may just buy Ireland. That's true. It's an old law. There are a lot of English actors, artists that live in Ireland, and Irish castles.
It'd be interesting. I think if we keep asking the Lord to show us what he wants us to do, bring to us the people he wants us to minister to, you know, you can only build the house right in front of you, build the wall right in front of your house. You can't build it out there. So, your daughter may come looking for more advice than you're expecting out of her, you know, especially if you keep the doors open. Other comments before we go? And I'd be glad to talk to you some more about it later. I don't want to throw a bucket of water on you. All right, somebody pray us out, please.